This is Jess Hall on the Cinematography Podcast.
This is Cinepod, the Cinematography Podcast, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image presented by Hot Rod Cameras. I'm your host, Ilya Friedman. Today on our show, I interview Jess Hall, the director of photography of Hot Fuzz and the Marvel series WandaVision. His latest film, streaming now on Disney Plus, is The Fantastic Four, First Steps.
You know, I was very aware that this was one of the original Marvel. It is the first family of Marvel. So I took that responsibility, you know, very seriously. You know, I did a lot of homework. I got very well prepared and I made sure, you know, that I was making choices that I thought would bring success to the project, you know, as well as, you know, tell the story that Matt wanted to tell.
In this episode, you'll learn all about the creative partnership between Jess Hall and director Matt Shakman. Creating the 1960s aesthetic through customized lenses, lighting, and color palette, shooting practical effects whenever possible, from huge sets to miniatures. Shooting Galactus in a real costume on a scaled-down set to create the illusion of immense size. After the interview, stick around for our short ends, our pet obsessions of the week. But first, find out what's grabbing our attention in the world of entertainment in close focus.
Let's do it! Heyo!
Hey, Ben. Thanks for coming back for another episode of the podcast.
I mean, you had to talk me into it.
It was a second there.
There was a minute where I was like, nope, I'm going to go be a juggler on the Santa Monica Pier from now on, and I'm not doing this podcast. And then you call.
Yeah, and then alternative reality universe of Ben. it was like something out of a Marvel movie. You said, all right, I'll be back. And then here you are.
I'll be back. All right, man.
So Ben, it is our close focus of the show. It's like what we, you know, what's going on in news, what's going on in the entertainment industry. What do we have to yak about this week?
Well, it was a thing that you brought to my attention. It was a new trend in vertical dramas, micro dramas, which is a move to horror. Which, you know, like I have yet to see a vertical micro drama that I was like, oh boy, I get it now. But as a horror guy, as a horror fan, as a horror maker, I was excited to check it out. And I did. It's called, Where Your Parents. We can put a link in the show notes. You can check it out. Like a lot of micro dramas, you get a bunch of episodes for free and then you gotta pay. And that's where the big bucks start rolling in. And, you know, I have mixed thoughts about it all. You know, I don't know anything about the specific production of Where Are Your Parents? But in general, and I have voiced this issue on here before, the thing about micro drama is I don't have a problem with short dramas. I don't have a problem with verticals. I don't have a problem holding my phone, you know, sideways to watch my phone. I don't have a problem holding it straight up and down. Portrait mode. Landscape mode. Who gives a shit? You know, if it's good, it's good, right? And a few years ago, Quibi kind of lost their shirt trying to make something like this. And they were trying to make high-end television-level drama. And I think that what has been figured out with the micro-drama world is that these are all like soap operas. They're tiny. They're very small budgets. They don't hire union anyone. They're done very, very fast. And that is actually where my issues with them come, which is like, if you want to say it's a nascent art form and we don't want to, you know, we don't want to strangle it in its crib by larding it up with union affiliations and making it cost too much. I understand that. But at the same time, there's like this nonstop boast of how many billions of dollars this industry is making. And they're not sharing it with the people who make it. They're not sharing it with the writers, the actors, the directors. And for people who are, you know, set dressers, prop masters, yada, yada. Like, you know, if you're in IATSE, you are allowed to work non-union. So, you know, while Hollywood is kind of dealing with basically a depression of shoots anyway, you know, we definitely have fewer things shooting. So if you're a crew member and you want to go off and do this, that's great. But for writers, actors, and directors, you know, if you're in one of the guilds, you can't work non-union if you are in the union. And so it kind of puts people in a weird position. Now, I have watched Where Are Your Parents? It definitely lifts a few very notable things from Weapons, like a lot, like a whole lot. But it's its own thing, and it's fine. And here's what I'll say about it. I see the potential. I definitely see the idea of making, like, I mean, when I say short, these are like a minute 45. So they're crazy short. They're designed to be binged, and they're designed to get you in and paying for them as quickly as possible. So, you know, like a good crack dealer, they give you the first few hits free, or I guess today it would be fentanyl. I'm showing my age by
using an unpopular drug of the moment of 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So, meth or whatever the kids are, Molly. I don't know what you kids do these days. I've always been boring in that department, but, you know, they give you the first couple of hits for free, and then they want to get you hooked, and then they want to get you in there. And I'm honestly all for it. And I think the episodes, I watched the free episodes of Where Are Your Parents? It's they look good. Someone care went into it. You know, I appreciate what people are doing with it. So that's my opinion. What's yours?
So I think it's interesting because I haven't watched the horror microdramas that you just watched or, you know, recently watched. I have seen some of the soap opera style ones, which is we're definitely all the we're all the money and all the hubbub's been about. And that's just not my genre. So soap opera has never really been my genre. There was a moment when I was sick at home in high school during a summer or something to that effect, where I remember watching some soap operas and being mildly sucked in. But it's never been like something that this is what I'm into. So, but I know for people out there who really like that, this is a potential. This is a potential form of entertainment that really hasn't been explored very much before, like Quibi from like 2020. So if we jump forward though to today, let's basically call it the rebirth of Quibi. And there's a bunch of stories throughout the trades that have been going on for the last several months, and various Hollywood power players who are trying to move into the microdrama vertical space. Look, I think it's going to get saturated really quick. Clearly, it keeps growing. It's estimated now to be a $26 billion industry, which is positive.
See, that's what I'm saying. It's $26 billion. Could you cut a deal with the Directors Guild and get basically a micro budget agreement out of it? I mean, come on.
Yeah, you know, I really don't know what the future of it is, though. I feel like the same way that people lost their shirts on Quibi, I think that people might end up losing their shirts on this too. I'm not saying that it's a bubble.
Well, I think the thing about Quibi is that they were definitely trying to make Fetch happen with Quibi. Mm-hmm. Like, they were like, we're going to make this thing for you, and you're going to fucking like it. And they were just like, here, look at our genius TV-like work, and you could turn it sideways, you could turn it vertical. And, you know, a producer friend of mine produced a pretty expensive series for them for Quibi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was telling me what a freaking nightmare it was, because they had to shoot every scene vertical and horizontal. And, you know, there were all these all kinds of problems. But I think that Quibi went at it the wrong way. And I feel like this is at least like nobody wanted Quibi. Quibi was the thing no one asked for. And I feel like this is a thing that people do seem to want. Like, there people are into it. Does it get saturated? I don't know. The interesting thing is, like, I'm with you. I don't like the soap opera stuff, and it's all like shitty melodrama, and so I get bored, and it's and so I look and I feel like it announces the badness of its acting because everything about it is so contrived. Mm-hmm. but watching this horror thing, and it might just be that, like, we click into a mode when we're watching horror or when we're making horror, like, it feels like I'm not going to say it feels as good as like Weapons or something like that, or Stranger Things, or, you know, like a bigger budget thing, but it looks fine. It looks good. It looks, you know, there's good mood. There's good camera work and design. I looked online, by the way, on IMDb on their page, no cinematographer listed, no director listed. So I can't credit anyone, but whoever did it, if you hear the sound of my voice, you know, good on you. Like I see, and they're doing it with a pretty limited cast. So I see the potential for that. That's all cool.
I mean, it's interesting because if you go back to sort of like the rhythm and beats of soap opera has to have something sort of like dramatic and over the top happening every, you know, every so often to keep people engaged. So
Well, these things are only a minute and a half long. So, you know, you have to, in a minute and a half, you have to tell a story. You know, you have to have a revelation.
And I think that's not very much the way that, you know, sort of the formula of soap operas. And they've just sort of now distilled that down to a little bite. So if that is something that you're predisposed to, it feels like the natural fit. But I don't know how mainstream that is. I mean, it's mainstream enough that they've claimed that they've made $26 billion or it's a $26 billion industry. But usually soap opera, you know, the magazines and the fan clubs and stuff, they were big, but they were kind of relegated to like a subsection of entertainment. They had the soap opera awards, the daytime television awards. They had all kinds of stuff that, yeah, that went along with this. And, you know, for all I know, they might still have it. But I think it's actually more than anything just proves how fractured the entertainment industry has become. And this is just another new portion of it, rather than saying that it is the future and that it's everything. I think it's just saying like, hey, here's another subsection, and that the audiences are ultimately getting smaller because of the way that people are watching things these days. I personally don't think that watching things on my phone is the best way to enjoy it, but there's plenty of people who do. So what do I know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Also, you don't have a job, you know, where you're sitting at a desk all day.
Oh, know, yes. Where you can watch soap operas all day at your desk. Now, granted, I know we're talking about horror specifically, and maybe the horror format will unlock new things. But I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. You know, this is a new trend.
You know, it'd be interesting to see is if one of these people decided to belly up to the bar a little bit. Those of us who work in horror are used to working for nothing. Like, there isn't an enormous amount of money until you become Ryan Coogler and you're making Sinners or something. So it's like, you could probably, an enterprising verticals person could reach out to the horror community, and they could get people who really direct horror movies. They could get actors who are well known from genre stuff. I'm not going to name names because I don't want to make it sound like my friends are on a fire sale, but I know a lot of people who work in that space who would probably be excited to have an opportunity to do this. And, you know, I mean, if somebody approached me and said, hey, would you be interested in developing, you know, directing whatever, a horror thing? I mean, I sort of did that with 20 Seconds to Live, you know, that was at my own freaking expense. Yeah. But if I had somebody else's dime and I could, you know, create an interesting, you know, narrative that's a minute and 45 second increments, I'd be interested to at least hear them out. You know, the schedules I hear they shoot these things on are, you know, intense, you know, like basically it's like shooting a feature film in 2.5 weeks, which is possible if you're the Asylum there, you know, or Roger Corman back in the day. There are plenty of people who do it. And I feel like, you know, other genres take note. You know, I bet if you got a really good bunch of sketch comedy or stand-up comedy people to do a workplace comedy like The Office, you might be able to strike gold if you got out of the freaking soap opera world, and maybe horror is their way to figure that out.
It certainly could be. I think that's a great place for us to leave it. Why don't we get to the interview with Jess Hall?
Excellent.
I'm joined now by cinematographer Jess Hall, the DP of the Fantastic Four First Steps movie, which is streaming on Disney Plus. Jess Hall, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
Thanks, Celia. I'm very happy to be here.
So last time you were on the show, you were here talking about WandaVision, and you got to speak with my co-host, Ben Rock. But you and I have never met, and this is wonderful because you've actually been on my list for a long time of someone I really wanted to talk about because, you know, for our listeners and viewers who don't know about your storied history, you've done one or two things that are like really, really cool. And I also just kind of want to throw out there, because I don't think a lot of people know about this, but you've worked with Wally Pfister as Wally Pfister's DP, which I think is pretty much Wally, I think, could pick anyone that he would want to shoot something for him, and he chose you, which I think is a massively high honor.
It was a great honor. I was very honored by that. Yeah.
You've worked with Edgar Wright, who, in my opinion, is like one of like, you know, the most incredible sort of like directors of his generation. You've done Marvel movies, which we're going to get into in a second here. Ordinarily, I like to start just immediately talking about the movie, which is Fantastic Four First Steps. But I kind of want to go back. I want to talk a little bit about like, you know, you and where you got the bug and how you decided that, you know, this was going to be something that you wanted to do.
You know, I think I was one of those people that I was slightly destined to do this. From a very young age, I was a very artistic kid and I was always sort of drawing. My sister was very bookish and she would like read the whole time. And our parents were very busy, so they left us alone a lot. So I was often in my imagination drawing, and that kind of artisticness was encouraged and just sort of developed. And I got into photography very early. I learned how to print photographs, you know, in the darkroom. And had a, you know, an old Canon A1 camera from about age, I think, 50. And I was pretty much inseparable from that. And then I kind of got curious about cinematography. And once I got curious about cinematography, it was kind of a one-way street, really, because it combined so many things that I was interested in terms of just the bigger sort of storytelling. You know, the incorporation of, like, working with a time-based medium. And, you know, it just was really intriguing to me. And so I ended up at film school. I you know, came out of film school shooting. I was already shooting before I'd left, you know, music videos, documentaries, you know, got into commercials, got into independent film, you know, with first movie was Stander, with Bronwyn Hughes, a true story about an apartheid South Africa in the 1970s. And then went on to Son of Rambo, which was made with a bunch of my film school friends. Garth Jennings directed it, produced by Nick Goldsmith and edited by Dom Leung. So we were all at college together. And then came Hot Fuzz. And that, you know, after those three movies, I think then, you know, I started to get attention and get more and more interest. So, you know, I've always been a visual person and, you know, I was lucky enough to have, you know, people around me who encouraged that and gave me some opportunities.
And Hot Fuzz is such an incredibly fun movie. It is fun from beginning to end, and it looks great. And I would really say that it was a leveling up for Edgar Wright, too, because I think at that time, by far the most ambitious movie that he'd ever made, and it had so many, like, you know, shootouts and chase scenes and all kinds of stuff in it, which is just incredible. So I don't want to, you know, go down the path too far. But do you have a particular story or experience from Hot Fuzz that you could share? Because, you know, it still holds up so great. I literally clicked it on the other day. It's such a fun movie.
I mean, you know, there's so much about Hot Fuzz. I mean, Edgar's, you know, he is an incredibly sort of technical filmmaker with an amazing imagination and great timing. And he has his sort of own style. And, you know, he does storyboards a lot. So I did kind of get storyboards and, you know, an incredible, he's a cineast. So, you know, we talked so much about different movies, you know, from Italian horror to American action movies. And so many of those things were incorporated in there. The story that I kind of love about Hot Fuzz is, you know, Edgar's style is kind of hungry. You know, he likes to cut. I mean, he's an editor in his head in many ways and loves these kind of fast cuts and inserts. And, you know, this very particular rhythm that he creates in his movies. And so we did a lot of setups, you know, per day. And, you know, one day sort of Edgar said to me, you know, like, he'd been to see, I think, George Lucas, and he'd been given these two lightsabers, these amazing kind of beautiful, you know, replica toy lightsabers, but they were beautiful and weighty and kind of worked and lit up. And my son was completely obsessed with Star Wars. And so he said, you know, if you do 35 setups today, you know, I'll give you the lightsaber for your son. So we went into the supermarket sequence. Actually, that was the second one. I can't remember what that day was, but we did 36 setups in that day. And I got the Darth Vader lightsaber for my son. And then Edgar said to me, you know, like, if you beat 36, I'll give you the Mace Windu lightsaber too. So then we went into the supermarket sequence, fight sequence, and we did 55 setups. And I got the Mace Windu lightsaber. and that was my son's favorite toys for like 5 years. We used to turn the lights off and play with those things. You know, he's still got them, treasured items. So it was just a really fun bit of trivia.
That's awesome. The handed down directly from Lucas and whatnot. And look at you're a really good father. Look at you. You're like you incorporated your goal into your work, and then you went off and pulled it off. And that's amazing. Now I get the feeling though that movie moved pretty fast. All the time, regardless
fast.
If there was a lightsaber on the line, it was
exactly. We were punching above our weight, you know. I mean, we were a smallish movie, and we wanted to feel like a big movie, and we wanted to treat the action movies like Tony Scott sequences, but we had an incredible amount of enthusiasm, and we had a great crew, and we were quite liberated in our naivety, and we just went out there and did it, and. It was great fun to work with them on that.
I want to shift gears a little bit now to Fantastic Four. Fantastic Four, it's a big movie, and there have been big hopes, I think, pinned on Fantastic Four is to be the next big sort of franchise. And sure enough, at the end of this movie from Marvel, there's a Fantastic Four will return sort of tease and everything else. Tell me, with this storied history of work, all the stuff that you've done, is there more pressure to something change when Marvel comes to you and says, here's this little project, we want to shoot it in 65mm, and we want to reboot and relaunch this franchise for us? Well, what goes through your mind?
It was a big responsibility, I will admit. I think it was a good point in my career to sort of take that on. I felt ready for it. I had a relationship with the good people at Marvel, having done WandaVision, and that having been, very much loved and successful both by the fans and I think by, the people at Marvel. And I had a relationship with the director, which is so important. And I have a lot of faith in Matt Shackman. So, I went into it with a lot of good, will behind me. But I think, I was very aware that this was one of the original Marvel, it is the first family of Marvel, incredibly important IP, and that it also really had to work, So, I took that responsibility, very seriously, and I did a lot of homework, I got very well prepared, and I made sure, that I was making choices that I thought would bring success to the project, as well as, tell the story that Matt wanted to tell. And it was a very appealing, story and a very appealing, franchise because, you do have the dramatic elements there, which, are intriguing and kind of give many, many layers to the story, which are not there maybe so much in some of the other characters, but it is a story about a family and parents and bring up a child, and there's a lot to kind of get into in that, as well as all the spectacle, which of course is a big part of it too. So yeah,
and of course Matt Shackman, the director of Fantastic Four, has an incredibly storied career in television, directed tons and tons of TV, including I know you worked together with him on WandaVision. And if I'm not mistaken, did you guys do another project together too?
Yeah, we did the first two episodes of Monarch. We did a pilot for another TV show that Matt produced called The Consultant with Christoph Waltz for Amazon. And we had sort of started working on another film that actually didn't happen, another big sci-fi project. So we had a decent body of work together and I think a good understanding. And there were elements of commonality between WandaVision and Fantastic Four immediately with the sort of the retro future and the mixture of, drama with action, science fiction, and even a little bit of comedy. So I feel like we were, we felt in a good place to get into it together, and to use some of the techniques and the kind of stuff that we'd built up on WandaVision could translate into moving into Fantastic Four.
Well, I kind of want to talk about that a little bit, like the director-DP relationship, especially on a project this size, and the pre-production process of what goes into this and visualizing it. I know that there's, production designers and storyboard artists and a whole team of people, but can you talk a little bit about, working with the director and working to, crystallize and create the look of the show or the movie?
Yeah, I think this, more than any other project I've done, you know, we really conceived a lot of this movie in pre-production. I mean, of course, there's things that transform in shooting and things that transform afterwards, but there's some very, very complicated sequences in this movie that were entirely pre-vised, and Matt and I sat in the room together from the beginning and figured out those sequences along with, you know, our wonderful pre-vis team and our visual effects team. And our production designer, but yeah, the consistency of, I think, sitting in that two-seater sofa with Matt Shackman, that's kind of what I'll remember in a way more than anything else from that pre-production, and just sort of looking at shots and kind of adjusting shots and figuring out, you know, camera moves and different, you know, techniques that we're going to use. That was a really, really big part of pre-production and of making this film. And those sequences, interestingly, we just had a screening at the BSC screening the other night at the IMAX Science Museum in London, and the Q&A involved me talking about the sequence from when, you know, they lift off in the Excelsior to when the baby's born. And you know, it's just like a 12-minute sequence, but it goes through so many different, you know, you've got zero gravity, you've got Silver Surfer, you know, you've got miniatures, you know, that we worked with miniatures on the Excelsior. You've got a massive set on a gimbal going through a neutron star, that was all a previous sequence and stayed very much intact, you know, when you look at the final movie. And it was the same for the third act, you know, where really we did, and a lot of work on Galactus, you know, trying to figure out the scale. A lot of that work was done in previs and in storyboarding. So, you know, very, very detailed with Matt. You know, we collaborate really well together. I mean, he's such an incredible director of drama. You know, he has a theatre background. You feel very safe that he has that arc and he has that storytelling instinct. You feel very taken care of in that department and very secure that the storytelling is going to work and he's going to know, you know how to handle that, as with the actors too. So it's a great collaboration in that sense. We're both doing what we do best. But of course, he has many, many opinions on what I do too. And we always enjoy talking about that as well.
Well, I want to get into a little bit of the nitty gritty of, you know, crafting the look. Like, it is a 1960s aesthetic, I would say, overwhelmingly. Yeah. And not just in production design and costume design and hairstyles and things like that. The lighting, while not as, I would say, uniform or flat as, like, maybe people would traditionally assume with the 1960s, there's lots of contrast in there. But there is very much an aesthetic. There's an intention through it that breathes a life that you're seeing something different. Not dissimilar in some ways to what was going on with WandaVision from the little bits that I've seen. But this, I thought, was it was really fun. It's a fun look. It's a look that I can't immediately place that I've seen anything else recently, like certainly not in my memory, that looks like this, which feels very original. And that, to me, I think is really interesting and difficult, because so often things are derivative. So often things like, oh yeah, it kind of reminds me of that, or oh, it's that with a little bit of this thrown in. Not this. This really does feel, on one hand, wholly modern and also throwback simultaneously. And that, to me, I think is really amazing. Can you talk a little bit about how that combination comes to be? Because and really feel free to get into some of the specifics or whatever secrets you feel. Yeah. Because I just haven't seen anyone do this, which is great.
Well, it's amazing that, you know, that you're saying that. And in a sense, that's kind of exactly what I was aiming for on this movie. You know, in my role as a cinematographer, perhaps more than anything else, I really wanted to create a kind of aesthetic that no one had seen before. And that's a kind of a tall order, you know. We've all
really
watched
tall.
A lot, you know. But that was my kind of goal. I didn't really know whether I'd achieve it or not, but it was certainly what I set out to do more than anything else. And I didn't quite know how I was going to do that, but I knew it was going to be very sort of multifaceted, like it was going to involve every single element of my craft, you know. And some of it I sort of played with on WandaVision, you know. It was sort of like getting that nostalgic retro feel, but then inserting some sort of like little twist, some sort of modernity in there, or something a little bit different that just didn't feel like an imitation of a 1968 movie. So you know, that was important to me, that kind of, that sort of mashing together, you know, a little bit. And, you know, I started looking at a lot of movies of the late 60s and looking at them in a lot of detail and like, what is that texture? You know, what are they, what's different about the way that the colors are working, the way that the films feel? And, you know, sort of imbibing that. And then I started, you know, testing lenses, working on optics and kind of thinking about customizing optics, which I've done quite a lot of. And also kind of with lighting, you know, and a lot with color, you know, really focusing on color, because I think one of the things, you know, and actually Wally used to say this, he was like, you know, the film digital debate, and I won't go into that too much, but he used to say, you know, like, no one's taking away my oil paints, you know, and giving me acrylic. I don't, you know, I want my oil paints. And so I think there's that sense of a print, you know, a film print that has that incredible richness. And I think as, you know, as we've moved into digital cinematography, I mean, people are really learning how to kind of manipulate that more. But there are certain aesthetics and motifs that I feel are quite familiar, and people can fall into tropes. And, you know, there's kind of fashions in color grading. There's things that feel a little bit too similar. And I wanted to kind of not go against the grain necessarily, but do something that was somewhat unique in the color spectrum, which honoured the kind of nostalgic late 1960s movies, but also was kind of comic book infused. And actually, when I was working on the early colour, you know, I was working with Ivan Lucas, who's a colourist at Company 3, and we found this 1968 comic book of Fantastic Four cover. And sort of just looking at the colours of that, you know, we were like, okay, well, you know, we started to incorporate that into some of the colour science. Specifically like the blue and the green and like the orange, and there's a pale blue that we kind of used. And without going into too much technical, we were really kind of manipulating the color space. You know, working very, very tightly with the production designer and the costume designer, with Kazra Farzani and Alexander Bryan. You know, very early I kind of set out of like, we've got to kind of unify this color palette. And so we were all kind of working within a very specific colour palette, which meant the film has a lot of colour unity to it. And that was sort of, I guess, the sort of different elements that I was playing with, you know.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I'm hoping to go into. Yeah, the colour is very distinctive, and definitely you can see the pale blues and some pale yellows and just sort of these greens that are vibrant and saturated, but also at the same time feel retro in this combination. And some of that works into production design. Some of it works in with lighting, and I'm sure the grade. When you were getting into lighting or grade, did you end up saying like, oh, I've got particular XY coordinates on certain lights that I was like, oh, no, I want to go slightly cooler with this? Or did, when you got into the grade, was it like, please give me a little bit more of this yellow? Tell me about how that combination happens, of like, you know, the practicality of getting the colors that you want to exist on set and seeing what it you want, and then finishing those same colors through your post-production.
I mean, I think, you know, the way that I work, and I think probably coming from a celluloid background, is, you know, I'm sort of designing my film stock in pre-production. Mm. So when I'm kind of working with that early color science, and when I'm working with optics and, you know, what camera sensor to use and different types of lighting, you know, I'm kind of developing a kind of my own little film stock. And then I do work with a single LUT, you know, a single lookup table, pretty much through the entire movie. I'm more and more working that way. So in that sense, it's a very unified kind of process that's pretty consistent throughout, and not that many variables, you know, which kind of helps, because then, you know, if you need to adjust the color of a particular wardrobe item because it's not looking quite right when you're testing, you know, or if you need to shift the color and temperature of a light slightly, those things, you know, you kind of isolate the number of changes you're making rather than kind of making multiple changes all the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a lot of testing, testing with costume, testing with art department materials and different paints and all the rest of it under my correct lighting, and very much sort of set to set, to be honest, as well. Like, different sets have different approaches. You know, for example, the big, you know, Reed's Lab, you know, I mean, that was all tungsten light. Mm-hmm. You know, we're using old Wendy lights, you know, And that was something that I'd kind of done on WandaVision, where I found that like using tungsten light with a digital camera and the right kind of color science got really interesting. You know, it was that there was an alchemy going on there, which, and just kind of really beautiful clean skin tones. And so that set, you know, had that going for it. But then, you know, when they go into like Galactus's tractor beam, you know, there's a red that's a very much like a 2001 Kubrick red, you know, which took also a different kind of like a work to get to. That's a really difficult thing to do in digital space. You know, there's different sets had different approaches. You know, it wasn't one single approach. I mean, there's a lot of space in the movie, and that space was very much designed, you know, in terms of color as well. You know, there's a kind of faster than light kind of mode that they're in the Excelsior, which is sort of all pastel. And then there's, you know, the hard light of kind of sun, you know, starlight, you know, there's the Earth's light. And the neutron star, which is a kind of Vittorio Storaro kind of gold yellow. And all of those colours were tested, and all of those colours were looked at as a kind of arc of a storytelling, you know, throughout that whole sequence. So, yeah, there's a lot that went into the colour, thinking about colour, controlling colour. And then coming to the grade with Tom Poole, who is the finishing artist at Company 3, I think he would admit that this movie fell in very easily, you know, because of all that work. The colour was sort of built into the workflow, built into the photography itself. And so then it was just getting that last layer on top, you know. And that was like, you know, adding some grain, you know, adding a little bit of density and you know, like just that additional halation and texture just to make it feel a bit more like a film print. And we looked at a lot of film prints, you know, as well to kind of get some reference. So, it was pretty, like, I find my color grading goes very smoothly because of the work that I do up front. So I can't remember like ever transforming a movie at that stage for me. It's really like, it's that extra 10-15% that I'm doing there, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that ideally is the best way to do it. I know that some people, they have to fight in the grade, but if you have done all the work up front and then it's just really the last 10 or 15%, that then it's probably a delight. It's probably a joy.
It is. It's very pleasurable. Yeah.
Well,
especially when you're working with Ivan Lucas and Tom Poole. I mean, these are some of the great color artists of our generation, you know?
Well, I got to ask, that this movie is filled with, you know, digital effects, you know, it's filled with VFX, things that can't be created any other way, but it pulls it off really, really seamlessly. And I'm wondering how difficult that is for you in particular, when so much of what you're seeing is not practical. And I'm thinking like I don't know, or is going to be enhanced. Like, you know, you've got someone who's, I'm assuming it wasn't practical, but the Ben Grimm character is like every inch of him is covered in what is appearing to be a rock surface. I'm assuming it was tracking marks or something, or there might have been a little bit of stuff, but that's got to then get, layered in with all the other stuff that's happening all around. So how do you wrap your brain around what I'm going to guess sometimes is 50, 60, 90% of stuff that's not there? It's against screen. Was it volume? Was it volume work? What was?
No, we didn't do any volume work. We tried to really minimize green screen and worked a lot on gray screen. We did do blue screen and we worked on black as well a lot for the space work and for Galactus ship. I think, you know, my partner in this was, you know, obviously, you know, Scott Stockdyke, the visual effects supervisor who I worked with incredibly closely. I mean, he did incredible work. And I think, you know, coming from Matt, you know, right from the beginning, it was like, you know, one of the big goals of the movie was to do as photorealistic visual effects as possible. So I think it was very much a sort of team effort. You know, we did a practical photography whenever we could. So, I mean, you talked about Ben Grimm, for example, you know, Ben Grimm, there was a Ben Grimm in full costume, who did a walkthrough, you know, for every scene at the end. So we had a reference of Ben walking through my lighting, you know, so that Scott could see exactly how he's behaving in the environment. Then, of course, you've got, you know, the mocap and the fractal suit and the Eben with the cameras, you know, on set. But yeah, it was it was as much as possible trying to give Scott as many practical elements to work with. And when we couldn't give him that, we gave him references. You know, the Silver Surfer was another big challenge. But, you know, we did have like this silver head that, you know, we used to put in the set, and I would kind of light with this silver head, and then I'd get Julia in, and then I'd get, you know, Julia's stunt double in the silver suit, you know, so we could kind of back and forth a little bit. Although Julia herself would generally just be in a fractal suit with mocap cameras. We're looking at, you know, real renderings of that, you know, of that texture within the environment. And then just being really kind of rigorous about lighting, you know, when we're doing process work, really trying to make sure that the lighting had a lot of integrity to it, even if you are just up against a process screen, whether it's green or grey or blue or whatever it is, you know. I think one thing that I really worked on Ghost in the Shell was very much that, like doing as much interactive and really kind of modelled lighting as I would do on a normal situation in the process work. And I think often, you know, it's harder in a way to control when you don't have backgrounds and you don't have real environments. So you have to really use your imagination and say, like, where is the light coming from? What are the sources? And almost kind of, you know, retrofit, you know, the lighting to make it feel realistic. So there's a lot of thought that goes into that. And then within the visual effects world, it's just being, I think, very meticulous. You know, obviously Scott does a lot of meticulous work, but in terms of respecting the lens optics, you know, I think one of the things is you cut to a visual effects shot and suddenly, you know, you've gone from a beautiful, like, modified anamorphic lens to a digital lens, you know, and I, you know, very early on, I looked at a couple of shots and I sort of said, you know, they've really got to look at the lens optics for each lens that I'm using and respect that. And Scott was like, absolutely. He went back to the vendors and made sure that was happening. And then from then on, we were really very, very consistent on that. And so the shots came out like with a lot of texture, and, you know, a lot of, you know, characteristics that were inherent to the actual photography. A lot of plate work, you know, wherever we could in New York, you know, we shot extensive aerial plates and ground plates, both as reference and as elements and as background parts to scenes. So, yeah, I think Matt was very concerned that this felt as real as possible. And I think every sort of member of the department, you know, every head of department got on board and did their bit, you know. And certainly for me, it was probably like, yeah, definitely one of the really big challenges I sort of set up at the beginning was, you know, got to kind of make this look realistic.
Yeah. And when you've got so much stuff that's going to be coming in later, I was curious about, like, I didn't realize, of course, it makes perfect sense to have like a Silver Surfer stand-in, to have a Ben Grimm stand-in, to actually give you some point of reference, because otherwise it's just in your head. It's in your imagination. Exactly. It's not. Wow. That's really interesting to me. I want to talk a little bit about lenses, because I know before we started this interview, you'd mentioned that you worked with the Ultra Panatar 2s, which are brand new lenses. They're brand new lenses that Panavision came out about a year ago. So you must have been one of the very first people to get hold of them. And for our listeners and viewers who aren't familiar with these lenses, these are essentially a more modern update of old vintage reduced squeeze 70mm anamorphic lenses, and they have I believe these are a 1.33:1 squeeze ratio, so not a traditional 2:1. Can you talk a little bit about working with these lenses, just because you're the first person I've talked to who's actually done a movie with them, and what working in that sort of like reduced squeeze ratio is like, and do you prefer it, or what's the feeling?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. They're pretty fresh out of the box, you know. They were quite new. They've been used on one or two things, but we were quite early there. I think, you know, the big bonus for me was, you know, I was able to, you know, they cover 1.9:1 for the IMAX. So, you know, we did protect the whole film for 1.9:1. And those lenses enabled me to do that while shooting, you know, some version of kind of anamorphic. So I was getting the kind of, you know, the compression in perspective that kind of I love from an anamorphic lens, and some of the kind of, you know, characteristics. But I was also able to kind of do that in an IMAX ratio. So that was really, really a big bonus and kind of probably the main reason I went to them. You know, we had used the UP1s on WandaVision, and I was very happy with them. But when the UP2s came out of the box, you know, I was like, okay, there's a lot I need to do to that lens before it feels like the lens that's going to render this world, you know. Not that there's nothing wrong with that, but it was, you know, it was too sharp, you know, the flares weren't right, you know, it wasn't a fast enough aperture, you know, we didn't have a real wide angle, so we had to make a 29mm. There was a lot that I did to those lenses with the help of Dan Sasaki at Panavision to kind of bring them into our orbit, you know. And that process took, you know, several rounds of testing and projecting at IMAX and looking at the camera tests. But yeah, it was a great starting point, you know, because they are kind of beautiful glass. And a format that covers IMAX, you know, a semi-anamorphic feel. But, you know, the joy of it was really getting in there and kind of making them our own in a way. And that's sort of what I think gives the film as well, that extra sort of texture.
So we'll have the full list over at camnoir.com, but you mentioned that there was a lot of different lenses that you, you know, like a cornucopia of lenses that came into play on this project. How do you go about deciding what lens is the best for a particular sequence or a particular shot or a particular feel of the movie? And was the bulk of the movie the Ultra Pantars, or was it one of these other, creations?
The bulk was the Ultra Pantars. Originally, you know, we were going to do a lot more in 1.4:3:1 IMAX, in full aspect IMAX. That shot count got kind of reduced, which meant we did a lot less with the actual, what I call the 2001 lenses, which were the spherical kind of set that we built. And those came out a lot in a way of my kind of appreciation for like the NASA photography of the sort of late 1960s, the Apollo 11 mission and sort of those missions around then, when they were using a lot of like Hasselblad, you know, Mamiya lenses and Hasselblad cameras and Hasselblad lenses. Those photographs were amazing and, you know, they were such great reference. And I think, you know, when we got off into space and we were going to go into 1.4:3, I was like, I kind of want it to look like that, you know. And so we started off looking at some vintage elements because that was kind of the obvious way to go. But then, you know, there was just this requirement to be super wide angle for Galactus. And they didn't really make those lenses in super wide angles. And then there was also, when we started projecting some of these vintage elements, they just didn't hold up in IMAX, you know, on the 80-foot screen. And so the other thing was, you know, I was trying to do miniatures with these lenses too. And so we had to adapt them to, they actually went to like a T45, I think, or T45 and a half. So incredibly like small aperture to give us this massive depth of field so that when we were shooting on the miniature Excelsior, you know, we could hold focus from back to front and that gives the illusion of scale. So once we started really testing, there was that. And at some point, I sort of took Dan into the IMAX stage and I showed him a couple of things. And I was like, yeah, that's a problem. He was like, we need to build these from scratch. Wow. You know, so we just started and we built this amazing wide angles, like the 18, you know, these low shots of Galactus going through New York and 18, 21, 24, 29, maybe 35 was a full build. And then when you got into like the 40, 50, 80, we used some of the early kind of Hasselblad and Mamiya glass, and that just did really feel very much like those NASA photographs that I loved. So that was kind of what that came out of. And then the Super Baltars, you know, I've been a huge admirer of Super Baltars for a long time. Actually, a cinematographer whose work I adore, Ed Lackman, he actually owns a set, and you know, he's used them extensively on projects, and I've used them on various things. But, you know, they're not designed for an Alexa 65 sensor, but I just like the idea of using something that was really kind of a little bit falling apart for the newsreel stuff. And so, yeah, we shot some 16mm for that. And then, you know, we weren't going to be able to do 16mm for all of that for one reason or another. And so we had a kind of digital version of that, which was like these kind of Baltars, which were really sort of textured, and I mean they're just original 60s glass that we didn't really do much to other than make them functional and expanded for the 65 sensor. So that was kind of that strand. So there's different like strands to this film, you know, and each kind of set of optics has its own place within these different strands.
Tell me a little bit about the experience of shooting miniatures. Had you done much miniature work before this, or was this a new territory?
A little bit, yeah. Not a great deal. I mean, we had a big ambition with miniatures, but, you know, they are very expensive to make. And, you know, we got scaled back a little bit in what we were able to do, but we did build a 12.5-foot Excelsior miniature. It was made by Ian Hunter, who built all the models for Interstellar, which is a film that we admire hugely. So that was fantastic to work with Ian, and you know, Ian came in when I was just kind of, you know, in the back room of Panavision, you know, trying to construct these lenses and figure out what to do with miniatures and IMAX, and he just came in and he just brought one of his models. He was like, hey, I've got like something that was left over, let me bring it in. And so Ian came in and we were kind of wheeling, you know, big lights around to create moving lights, and Ian had his team, like, you know, moving this miniature, and we were testing these lenses, and so it was great working with Ian, and he built a beautiful miniature, and we were able to do a lot with it. I mean, we really figured out how to use it for a lot of the Excelsior scenes, even kind of using some lasers and stuff to kind of simulate some of the lighting interaction when the ship's pulled into the Galactus's world ship. We had a great miniature photographer, Nigel Stone, in London, who helped us with that, and it was really fun working with that. I wish we could have done more, but you know, it was, as I said, it was sort of like at the end of the day, even these big movies have a limit, you know.
Oh, for sure.
A lot to achieve, and we built some massive sets. You know, I mean, the Times Square set was absolutely enormous. It was, I think, only 20% smaller than the original 1968 footprint of Times Square.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask about that specifically, because of course you've got, you know, Galactus, who is the size of a 150 story building or something like this. Yeah. I was wondering
he's about 800 foot.
130? Yeah.
He's about 800 foot. Yeah. I think 130 could be about right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I assume from watching the movie that it was not a guy in a rubber suit. It was not a Godzilla movie. You guys had to, create this digital character. And you've got, quite often in miniatures, you've got, off frame rates. You've got different frame rates to try to
absolutely.
Make. So I'm assuming that you've got these scales worked out, and you've then got your off frame rates to try to, like, match as quickly as close as possible. Plus then you've got these really, really high light levels, because you're trying to get, like, you know, F45 or
exactly,
whatever it might be.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a complex stew that you're making here with a lot of different ingredients.
Very complex. And yeah. I really dropped myself in it, you know, because I said to Matt at some point, like, you know, I had this ambition of, like, you know, because he was like, I really want to get Ralph Ineson in a Galactus suit. I want Alex to build a Galactus suit. And I want to photograph him in this suit. And I was like, well, I think I've got a plan that I can kind of get, like, an extended depth of field for you. And we could actually kind of shoot him like a miniature, basically. And so Matt was like, I love that idea. So then I had to kind of deliver that. And that was really difficult. We did shoot, actually, Ralph in a Galactus suit, an incredible suit that Alex built, on a stage lit to about T22.5 or T32 for all his performance beats, and we kind of replicated those camera moves, and, you know, I had 100K soft sun, you know, in a studio lighting him, and a ton of other lights, because, you know, Matt is ultimately a performance director, you know, he's an actor's director, and he wanted that performance shot for real. And of course then, you know, you have the digital version of the character, you have the mocap as well, you know, data for Ralph, so you can kind of, like, use all those elements then. But I think, you know, and you'd have to talk to Scott on a shot by shot basis to get exactly what he did where, but I think, you know, if nothing else, he had an incredible reference for, you know, and the suit that Alex made had so much detail in it, so he had a great, and we had Ralph's eyes, you know, which was really important. We always had his facial features and his eyes as real photography. And a lot of camera moves that were built around his performance, you know, on a stage, you know. So that was really, really very interesting. And then, you know, we had the problem of tying that into New York plates, of course, and aerials. And so very, very technically very challenging.
I imagine. And you've got other scenes with Galactus too, where he's like looming in the background, and you've got the, you know, the Fantastic Four in the foreground, and you've got all this. I was wondering if these composites involved some real photography, or if it was all CG.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They definitely involved real photography. They involved a lot of CG as well. But we had real photographic elements for the four, on a set piece, which we built at this massive stage in Pinewood with the tallest stage. I say about that world ship that it's a space that's hard to intellectualize because it's consuming planets.
Yeah.
So you start to think about the scale there and how to light that to make it feel realistic. But we had them raised up on these walkways, and we'd shoot them, and then we would shoot Ralph, at an incredibly high, light exposure to get full depth of field for him on the suit to kind of composite into these shots. So they all had real elements, and then it was up to Scott to decide whether it worked and how much he had to replace in CG and how much he could use of the real,
Well, mission accomplished. I mean, this really is this really is so much fun to look at. I mean, like there are movies that I see which have a lot going on emotionally and empathy and whatnot, but not necessarily the visual bonanza that captivates you and takes you into another place. This movie, even if you were just to mute it and know nothing that's going on and to look at it, it looks like some incredible, and I want to say like fever dream teleporting of into this 1960s world, but like I said, not like something I've seen before, and congratulations on
a huge compliment. I appreciate it. Yeah.
It's I have even more respect for what you've pulled off now here having you describe and talk about how you went about doing it, because this is no small feat. This is filmmaking at the highest level. It's so hard to create all of these different elements and have them all work together and have them fit seamlessly. I gotta ask you, so now that you've got this really varied history of work, including now tons of science fiction, is there a genre that you haven't tackled yet? Do you want to go to horror, or do you want to go back to indie film? What's next for you? Where are you hoping to take on?
I'm very open-minded. I think I am interested to tackle genres I haven't tackled. I would like to do horror of a sort, but I'm very particular about the kind of horrors that I like. It's probably the genre where I'm the most fussy. There's probably a very handful of films that I actually really respect in the horror genre. So it'd be difficult for me to find one, but I do think it's an amazing genre. But science fiction at the moment is really intriguing to me, and I think because, for a number of reasons. I think one, because of where we're at as the human race, we're at this point where, when I made Transcendence with Wally, this is a movie about AI, essentially. This is a movie about sentience, about, reaching the ultimate, super intelligent, conscious, computer, like downloading the human consciousness. It's Kurzweil, it's all this early science fiction theory. And, at the time, I think people hadn't really been exposed to those ideas, but now it's like everyone is aware that this is kind of happening, and it's sort of happening in our lifetime, So it's really interesting to explore that cinematically, and also like technologically. I feel where cinematography is going, it's offering so much. I feel like this wonderful combination of using techniques from the past, like miniatures, and then using kind of the best version of like mocap, or that Imaginarium and people like that are doing, and incredible CG artists, and you bring all these things together, and I just feel like as artists we've got an incredible palette to draw from now, and science fiction just has the capacity to use your imagination to create something really wonderful. So it's definitely, I'm not done with it, but I also I love the kind of I love big dramas, to be honest, and I think there's not enough of them made anymore. I think, a lot of the films of the 70s that did that really well, I would love to see a return to that kind of, and if I ever got the opportunity to make something like that, I really admire those films, so I'll be looking out for something like that. That would be a gift.
Well, Jess, I think that's a great place for us to leave it. Thank you so much for being on the show. Is there a place online? Do you do any social media or anything that people can follow you?
I've got my Instagram. It's not my name. It's Metro Rat, which is my DJ name, actually.
Nice. Oh, okay. So when you're not lighting the sets, you're scratching the wax, or you're
vinyl only. That name kind of stuck, and for some reason I started that Instagram a long time ago and decided to use that name, so it hasn't changed. So you can find me there, and then, you know, my website is available to everyone, jesshalldop.com. You can reach out to me on that if you want to send me something.
Jess, fantastic. So we'll put links to the Metro Rat Instagram, as well as also your official website over at camnoir.com. Right. Thank you so much for being on the Cinematography Podcast.
Thank you, Ilya. Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks for having me.
So that was Jess Hall. Jess, thank you so much for being on the show. It was great talking to you about Fantastic Four.
I think you mean it was fantastic talking.
It was fantastic talking with Jess Hall. So, Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's where we talk about our pet obsession. You got a pet obsession this week?
All right, there's two things I want to talk about.
Oh,
one of them is really fast.
Double. Okay.
Well, I wouldn't call it two short ends, but like one of them is something I just kind of want to plug. If you're listening to us, then you clearly are into podcasts. Check, and we've talked about The Town with Matt Bellamy. Mm-hmm. Matt Bellamy had a two-parter that dropped this past Monday with James Cameron. And it's just a one-on-one interview with him, with James Cameron, in two parts. It's about an hour-long interview with James Cameron, and they talk about everything.
Wow.
And it is very worth listening to, because Cameron talks about his new Avatar movie, which undoubtedly we'll be talking about before you know it. But he talks about working with motion capture, performance capture, rather. He talks about the state of the industry, the state of VFX. He talks about AI, the things that scare him. He talks about, you know, where he sees the industry going in general. I think if you are interested in knowing, you know, James Cameron, I think, is one of the smartest and best operators that this industry has ever had, as a director, as a writer, but also just as a guy who pushes the industry. He decides he's going to do something, and the industry is forced to follow him, and they do somehow. I don't know how he does it. And it's such a great interview, and it in a weird way, it humanizes him, because you know we hear all these stories about James Cameron, and he sounds like some kind of a robot who, you know, a robot from the future sent here to make movies. And definitely check it out if you can. But my real short end.
Your real short end. I'm ready.
Have you heard about Deathstalker?
No, but I why does it not surprise me that you or your short end is something called Deathstalker?
So Deathstalker was, I believe, two movies that came out in the 80s. Mm. Sword and sorcery movies, kind of in the vein of stuff that was around in the 80s, like Beastmaster, The Sword and the Sorcerer,
yeah.
Excalibur. Like there are a lot of these things. And so Deathstalker is it's a new movie that is kind of a quasi remake, reboot, reimagining of Deathstalker, done in very perfect cheesy 80s sword and sorcery mode.
Wow.
It's directed by a guy named Steven Kostansky, and he directed a movie I saw a few years ago called Psycho Goreman. That is Psycho Goreman. Sounds super gross, but it's about like a little girl who gets a demon, and it's like all practical effects. So it's a dude in a suit.
Oh, cool. That's great.
And he's like this monster demon, but he has to do whatever this little girl tells him to do. And it's very funny and full of heart and brilliant. So Deathstalker is from the same director and the same DP, by the way, Andrew Appel. He's got some decent credits, but the biggest ones are things like Psycho Goreman and Deathstalker. So Deathstalker is 100% practical effects. If they used visual effects in any way, maybe it was, I don't know what it would be, because I feel like I could see the wires on stuff. So they weren't even using it to paint those out. It's very, very practical. And it stars a guy named Daniel Bernhardt. And Daniel has I have a soft spot for Daniel because when I was a makeup effects artist, I was the assistant makeup artist on Bloodsport 2, which Daniel was the lead in. And I've talked about Bloodsport 2 probably here once or twice because it was such a weird experience, possibly to this day, the weirdest professional experience in my life. So Daniel is Deathstalker in this and voicing what appears to be a little person in a weird costume is Patton Oswalt as his sidekick. So, like, these people know the exact tone they're going for, and they nail it. Is it gross? Yes, but it's so gross that I kind of defy anyone to be grossed out by it. Like, it's extremely over-the-top, cartoonishly bloody. Watch the trailer. If the trailer grosses you out, don't see it. But as we head into the holidays, and everything gets treacly and pretty and has a soft, focusy bloom filter on it. Or, on the flip side, is Oscar competitor kind of stuff, and it's all prestige. I would encourage more people to take a break. Go check out Deathstalker. It's wall-to-wall goofy fun. It knows unlike watching an Asylum movie where it's like a serious filmmaker wasn't really given a chance to do the thing they wanted to do, so they did a half-assed compromise thing that kind of sucks. This is the opposite. This is someone who decided to make this kind of movie exactly this way. And it's, is it low budget? I don't know what the budget is. It's certainly made to look low budget. It's certainly, but it has nods to all those movies I just mentioned. Beastmaster, definitely a huge nod to The Sword and the Sorcerer, if you ever saw that movie. It's just goofy, goofy fun. And I am pretty sure that the people who made it would be happy to know that that was how I described it. Definitely check it out. Worth every second. Just pure fun.
Wow. Okay. Super cool. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know anything about that. It was not on my radar.
What?
So,
what? Yeah. Watch the trailer. Like when we get done with the recording, watch the trailer. I'd love to see in real time your reaction to the trailer for Deathstalker.
Okay. I'm interested. Yeah, I'm curious for sure.
Yeah. What is your short end this week?
My short end this week is it almost feels like a counterpoint to our close focus, which is basically the anime / animation industry. Like, you know, I've been known to enjoy something animated or anime. I did watch K-pop Demon Hunters. It is the most popular animated show in the history of Netflix now. And I came across an article that was quite interesting about Netflix paying an extra $15 million to Sony basically to secure rights to be involved with like the sequel to that. So it was like there was no contract, there was nothing that said like, hey, you know, you have to do a sequel with us. They had no option they could exercise. And so part of the negotiation was that Netflix just basically said, hey, you know, this did really well for us, here's an extra $15 million, which, considering I think they only paid $20 million up front for it, it was like, yeah, they basically doubled down. But
$15 million is their theatrical release from a few months ago for just one weekend, and they got to keep $5 million of it still. So.
Exactly right. So, but it made me question, like, what is the size of the Japanese animation market specifically in Japan? Because Japan is a small country, but it's a very, very popular genre. So people, you know, there's a lot of anime on TV, there's anime in the movie theaters, and it's estimated between about $22 and $29 billion. So it's about the same sort of size market that's currently being estimated for.
Wait, so vertical videos make more money than anime? I don't buy
vertical
it.
Videos worldwide versus anime in Japan. This is not the size of the anime market worldwide. I assume that the anime market worldwide is massive. This is just specifically Japan. So it was interesting to me to kind of look at like how these two things are counterpoints to each other, because anime is not for everybody. My wife has told me many times that she does not want to watch anime. She finds it too shrill or for whatever it is. There's occasionally something she will watch, but it's not her genre. It's not her thing. Interesting though, Gen Z is very much interested in anime. So it makes me kind of think, like, as genres get mashed up and shoved together, like, what are we going to see next? Are we going to start to see anime horror short format verticals that are created by humans or AI? I don't really know, man, but it's like
you're giving them ideas, man. Hey, yeah. By the way, I have a sorry, just popped into my head. It's interrupting your short end. Here's my $1 billion idea. We create the vertical awards, the vertices. What are we going to call it? We created the Oscars for vertical drama. Anyway, go on.
That's great. I think it's great, but I got no time to create an award show. Anyway, I think it's really interesting. I don't know what genre is going to capture people's imagination next. I expect there to be more mashups. I think that the tickling of neurons that happens from people watching short form video is definitely a thing. How much that erodes traditional entertainment, I can't really say, because I still really enjoy watching a movie or a television series like on a big screen, either in my living room or in a theater. So I feel like they're different things. I don't want to sacrifice my enjoyment of a good series or a good feature from that bigger screen experience in order to have it on have a experience on a phone. But maybe I'm in the minority. Maybe there are other people who do. So I'm not really sure what the future holds. But I think that the bets on these different formats, there's a good chance that there is a market for it. How large that market is, I don't think it's the same size as the traditional entertainment industry. So I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, the fracturing continues.
All right. So Ben, that does it for us. This was another episode. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
You can go to benrock.com and check out my socials and watch my reel. I need to update my reel, but also I need to go make something new so I have something with which to update my reel. Might be doing that in the next month or so. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
You can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. If you need gear, cameras, lenses, lights, posts, anything like that, Hot Rod Cameras can help you out. Highly technically competent people can help you, and they're really friendly at the same time. So that's my day job. Ben, who do we have to thank? Who made this show possible?
I mean, Alana Cody, top to bottom. Holy crap. She's producing, editing, doing all the stuff. We got to thank her for everything. And then we got to thank Kays Alatrakshi for composing all the music that we used on here. Check out his website, musicbykays.com. Check out his YouTube page where he fixes synthesizers at Kays Labs on YouTube.
Well, Ben, I think that just about does it. Thanks for tuning in.
This has been CinePod, the cinematography podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory at hotrodcameras.com. Watch and subscribe to our show on YouTube or listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow and interact with us on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, Blue Sky, and LinkedIn, but not Twitter. Thanks for tuning in.